Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. Now, here is your host at the Virtual Center, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being with us today. This is Bill O'Brien. On this Thursday, it is the 14th day of March, and 2013, and we're so glad to have you with us today. We do not have regularly have a program scheduled on Thursdays. We've been on trying to operate on a Monday through Wednesday schedule, but since we lost yesterday's program, and since I usually teach on Thursdays at this time, but because we're on spring break this week, we are not, our classes are not meeting today, so I was available today to try to make up for yesterday's program, which we weren't able to get on because of technical difficulties. And let me share with you the fact that Bob and I are working furiously to make sure that we clean up these technological glitches and get on with the issues at hand, which are so much more significant and so much more important than those. Again, thank you so much for being with us today. If you are interested in calling and making a comment or offering a suggestion or a point of view on anything we're talking about, I would love to hear from you. Call number at the Head On Radio Network is area code 304-658-3333. It's a very easy number to remember, 304-658-3333. And as our programs go on and as we move into coming weeks, we'll be making better and better use, more use of the PRISM West Virginia website. There I anticipate that we'll be able to put documents and subject matter that we plan to discuss in the following day's program and give folks an opportunity to take a look at it before they call, rather than me just reading text, which I don't like to do, but I found myself almost required to do, at least here at the beginning. If I may, I would like to continue from where we were going the day before yesterday. Again, we didn't have yesterday's program. But if you remember, we were talking, I think, talking about one of the major issues surrounding the ratification of the Constitution of the United States and the replacement of the Articles of Confederation by the Constitution with that ratification. And specifically, we were talking about the issue of republicanism. And it is my thesis. In recent weeks, I've been focusing quite a bit on this particular subject. I believe it is very, very important, namely the differences between Federalists and Anti-Federalists over the issue of Republican government itself. If you remember, throughout the ratification struggle for the Constitution, the one point that I was trying to make the other day is that both Anti-Federalists and Federalists were claiming a firm commitment to the idea of Republican government. And as we were mentioning at the very end of our program, both sides would go back to the theories of Montesquieu in his Spirit of the Laws, in which he talked about the nature of Republican government. And the other day we mentioned the fact that Anti-Federalists, and we had looked specifically at an Anti-Federalist document out of the New York newspapers in late 1787, authored by the acronym Brutus. And basically, the argument was that the nature of the power that was contained for the federal government within the Constitution of the United States suggested that this would not be a Republican government at all, but that, in a sense, it was there was so much power in the power of the central government and so much size to the nature of the union that the Constitution created that the Republican government as defined by and advocated by Montesquieu would not be possible. And he pointed out, in fact, he said specifically, that the Greek and Roman republics, by definition, was small in area because the very nature of a republic was that elected officials must be able to stay in close contact, in touch with their constituents, so that they can know the needs and wants of the constituents, and so the constituents can know and have easy access to the representative. And the only way to ensure, Montesquieu believed, that that kind of a reciprocal relationship between the elected representative and those who elect him can function is if the republic is small. However, the Federalists, the advocates for ratification of the Constitution, argued that while there were many changes being made between the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation, which it was replacing, the fact of the matter was that the Constitution was still preserving the nature of republican government. And again, the point that I was making is that Federalists tended to focus more on the issue of electing representatives. The fact that government was popular, the fact that citizens could participate in the process by having regular elections and being able to elect their representative, to them, that and all the trappings of American electoral politics which followed from it, heated campaigns, campaign literature, political rallies.
Dr. Bill?
Yes, Bob.
Sorry to interrupt, but okay. We're going to reconnect, okay? Stand by.
Okay, we'll reconnect. Thank you.
We now rejoin Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob. And that the nature of republican government under the Constitution, the Federalists argued, was preserved. And what they were focusing on was principally the accoutrements of electoral politics that we know so well. Political parties, political campaigns, literature, campaign speeches, and all the rest of it. And so the point that we were making right at the end of our program the other day is that it is my interpretation from this that, in effect, the very nature, the very heart and soul of republicanism as explained by Montesquieu and as advocated by the Anti-Federalists was being lost. And that in the process, something quite different was being created. And that something quite different was a redefinition of republicanism which focused principally on the activities of participation, the electoral process itself, the election of representatives, but that in effect the major change made in the transition from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution was a transition in the relationship between voter and the elected representative for whom the voter voted. And if you remember the other day, we read a passage from a very, very famous speech in England by Edmund Burke. And Burke's position was that the role of the representative is to listen very carefully to the opinions of constituents, to know what constituents wanted, but to never be subject to instructions or direction, if you will, from the constituents, that the representative, the elected representative, must be the decision maker. Granted, that representative must act from an awareness of what the needs of his constituents were, but you never sacrifice the power to make decisions from the representative to the constituents. And so that change, I would suggest, is a really, really significant one. It changes the whole nature of republican government. As I mentioned at the end of our last time together on Tuesday, it literally takes the heart and soul out of the meaning of republicanism as it existed. And I think that it's very, very, it's a very, very significant issue. Let me just share got so many pages of notes here, I'm getting confused. I wanted to share with you a Federalist position on this issue of republicanism. We looked quite carefully the other day at the piece by Brutus, and he talked about using examples within the Constitution to suggest that the nature of the power that the Constitution was giving the federal government essentially meant that this government was quite different than the Confederation, that the new union being defined by the Constitution of the United States was no longer a confederation. Therefore, the units within it, in the nature of the Confederation, it was the states themselves. The units within it were no longer Republican forms of government at all, because the power of the central government over the states made republicanism a moot term. At least that's what Brutus believed. And you will remember that I made reference to a comment that James Madison made about the Brutus Articles. And if you remember, there were a total of 16 different articles by Brutus in opposition to the Constitution of the United States. The first one we looked at, the one that was published in the New York newspaper in October of 1787. And Madison made the point that the Brutus Articles were on target. I mean, I think that's very significant. The author of the Constitution is acknowledging that the things that Brutus is saying about the Constitution are on target and literally strike at the very foundation of the new government that the Constitution creates. I think that's very significant, because if it does nothing else, it gives credibility to the tenor and to the substance of Brutus's argument. After the Constitution was ratified and the Constitutional Convention closed in September of 1787, the first state to take up ratification was the state of Pennsylvania. And a leading supporter within the Pennsylvania Convention was James Wilson. And James Wilson is very, very prominent at this time. He's a leading Federalist. He's a Philadelphia attorney. Very, very prominent, very, very bright. And in the Pennsylvania Convention, James Wilson is addressing this issue of republicanism under the new Constitution. And he makes the point that the new Constitution is really creating the best of two worlds. He says it is, and this is a quote, "a species of government which secures all the internal advantages of a republic at the same time that it maintains the external dignity and force of a monarchy." Wilson is saying, in a sense, that the elements of republican government are being retained in the Constitution, while at the same time the Constitution is giving the new government the kind of power and dignity and position in the world to earn respect rather than the disdain of other nations with which we will have to do foreign policy. And James Wilson himself quotes from Montesquieu, and this is a classic example of taking content out of context. He cites Montesquieu, the very advocate, the very creator of the idea of, and supporter of the idea of republican government. Excuse me. And he goes to Montesquieu and cites the following from Montesquieu, who says that republicanism consists in assembling distinct societies which can be consolidated into a new body, an expanding quality peculiarly fitted to the circumstances of America. So in a sense, what Wilson is doing is pulling from Montesquieu comments, pieces of information, which suggests that the kind of size that the new union is creating under the Constitution is not really contrary to the nature of republican government at all. And yet, if you read the substance of Montesquieu, it's very, very clear that that is indeed, quite indeed, what is happening. I feel, personally, that this is a very, very important significance. And the point I made the other day, and I want to make it again, because I think it is significant. I would suggest to you that these players in this political process, Federalist and Anti-Federalist leaders, these are not unknowing, unintelligent people. They know very well what's going on. They are all attorneys. They are very, very shrewd and gifted in the language, in legal language. And they know very well what the nuances of language are in the major differences between approaches to Republican government. And I would suggest that the very fact that the size of the republic created under the Constitution makes the relationship between voter and elected representative quite different than it would have been in a small republic under Montesquieu is not by any means an accidental loss in the process. That in fact, the very things that anti-federalists complain about in terms of the change in republicanism is exactly why the federalists want that change to happen. In other words, the weaknesses in republican government under the Constitution that the anti-federalists emphasize are exactly the reasons why federalist leaders want so badly to make this change. They aren't ways that republicanism will have to change. They are ways in which republicanism can no longer function. I think it is very significant because if you create, and Madison says this very, very clearly in Federalist Number 10, if you create a large, Madison calls it an enlarged sphere, a larger congressional district. Madison says by creating a larger district, you take in more different groups, more competing factions. Madison says you make it less likely that there will be a majority faction to make the decisions. Rather, you will have a series of minority factions competing for influence. And by that very process, the power to make decisions goes from the electorate to the representative. In other words, in the face of competing factions, none of which is a majority faction, the representative is left with the authority to make the ultimate decision.
And Dr. Bill, I'm sorry, I know this must, well, before too much gets lost in the signal degradation, let's restart.
Okay.
Sorry. We'll be right back. This is the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution with Dr. Bill O'Brien. And we will return to the topic at hand momentarily. Dr. Bill, I believe we're good to go again.
Bob, we're good and strong. It sounds like we stay strong for a while anyway. The point that I was making is the very size of the constituency and the fact that it embraces a number of competing factions, none of which Madison assumes will be a majority faction, means that in the face of different competing factions seeking the representative's favor, the representative himself becomes the decision maker. So power is shifted from the voters to the elected representative. And in effect, by enlarging the sphere, by replacing the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution, the approach to representation, the approach to a Republican government advocated by Edmund Burke is in fact implemented within this new nation. And this becomes the operative definition of republicanism as it is adopted here in the United States of America. I think it is very significant because while the trappings of republicanism are constantly advocated and committed to, the fact of the matter is many of them are kept, but the one that is not is the key factor that determines whether the constituents will have power over the representative, or the representative will have decision-making power in the face of competing interests among constituents. The transition of power is the key issue here. It is an important one, and it is not one that the founders, either side, supporters or opponents of the Constitution, did not understand very well. And so when Madison says that the Brutus Articles, all 16 of them, are literally aiming at the foundation of the nature of the Union under the Constitution, he is speaking very, very seriously, very substantively. What he is suggesting, what he's saying in effect is, this guy really knows what he's talking about. And he's right. Therefore, I have to suggest to you that the nature of ratification, the nature of the adoption of the Constitution of the United States itself, is a major change, a major reform in American politics. And I think it is very, very significant. It doesn't mean, and I told myself before we got back to this today that I have to make this case. So please, bear with me on this one. It doesn't mean that we're talking here about good guys and bad guys. We're talking about the way politics works. And we're talking about very shrewd, creative, insightful individuals who have a particular point of view and know how to play the game in ways that get their point of view enacted. So again, we're talking about politics here. The fact of the matter is, the founders knew that in the society that they were dealing with, which was 18th century America, it was a class-based society. And in spite of the fact that the Declaration had said that the Creator had created all men equally, the fact of the matter is, the founders knew that everybody wasn't equal. And a majority rule democracy where the majority of your people are able to make decisions is in effect shifting decision-making power from the people who are most qualified to make it to the people who are least qualified to make it. To them, to Madison and the others, this was the major danger of the Confederation, because the Confederation left power at the state level and created a weak central government. Consequently, by putting power at the local level, you made it more and more susceptible to majority rule, to the control by constituents, rather than control by their elected representatives, who Madison and the others believed were far more capable of making the key decisions. So, in a sense, their determination to replace the Confederation with the Constitution was an extremely important process, because it literally changed the nature of who was going to make decisions in American society, the most qualified or the least qualified. This is the issue. And the way it's played out is in the debate over the nature of Republican government. So it is not, I don't believe, that is, it is in the context of good guys and bad guys and devious politicians and all the rest of it. This is what the stakes of this ratification process are about. And it's very, very important to understand them, understand those stakes, those, you know, what the issues are. And once we do that, we can begin to appreciate what it was that drove the priorities of both sides in the ratification struggle. Many of the anti-federalist opponents of the Constitution were prominent people in their own states, and they saw that by weakening the power of the states and transferring that power to the central government, in effect, they were losing influence. They were losing power at the state level. It's not that they were Democrats. They were probably, my guess is, many of them, depending on who you're talking about, were as committed to the idea of a class-based society as anybody else. The difference between them was, do you have to shift power to the national level and away from the state level in order to preserve the kind of society you wanted? These anti-Federalist leaders did not believe that was necessary. The Patrick Henrys and the Richard Henry Lees and the others, they were not majority rule Democrats. They were people who believed that Republicanism could really work if you put power at the local level and made it possible for elected representatives to know the needs and wants of their constituents. Madison and his Federalist colleagues had concluded, and the history of the Confederation period seemed to bear it out for them, that there's no way that you could do this. The only way that you could ensure order and stability in society and a future for the United States of America is to basically remove power from being so close to the people, shift it into a new context, which is the federal level, which made it impossible for the majority faction to get control. And to Madison, that was the only way that you could create stability and order. And by preserving the political process, the trappings of republicanism, the elections and the campaigns and the broadsides and the articles and the speeches and the money and the contributions and the parties and all the rest of it, by preserving those trappings, you were preserving the aspects of republicanism that made it possible for people to participate in the process. You were, as Madison said, you were reserving the spirit and the form of popular government, but you were making it absolutely impossible for the majority to make decisions to seize control. So in a sense, if we were to contact Madison, we were able to ask Madison one question if you had an audience with the side, so to speak. I would suggest to you that Madison would probably say the Constitution was the best of two worlds. We were able to create security and stability and order. We were able to preserve a society in which the people were able to participate in the political process and participate in the laws under which they were being required to live. But at the same time, we were making certain that the right people called the shots, that the right people made decisions. We were creating stability and order in society. We were making it possible for the well-to-do to invest in a future which they knew would be there, because they would ultimately be controlling it. That's my sense. That's pretty much what Madison would probably say. I want to go back, if I can, to an issue that we were talking about earlier, and it's the idea, given this story about republicanism and about ratification of the Constitution, which I think is a very, very significant and important issue, then it seems to me we need to go back to this idea about the people being the best depositories of their own rights. And the idea that our elected officials, if you remember, Madison took issue with this, was the very first thing we looked at this past Monday. The idea that Madison said that there's a general impression out there that all politicians will do the wrong thing unless the people are there to watch them and force them to do the right things. And if you remember, Madison said that he doesn't really believe that, but that he puts faith in the wisdom of the people to elect the right people. And you know, we talked about that. So the question then is there a contradiction in Madison? How do we resolve the contradiction here because of his seeming faith in the people's ability to keep government and elected officials on the straight and narrow, and at the same time his unwillingness to trust them with power in their own hands? I think this is an issue that we really have to address. First of all, we have to be aware of it. The convention meets in 1787. The Constitution is ratified in 1788. And Washington is elected and takes over as first president in 1789. Madison becomes president after Jeff in the election of 1808. So he moves in to power in 1809, and he is president for two terms. So Madison leaves office in 1816, after the election of 1816, the election of James Monroe, another Virginian. This letter is written in 1822, so it's another 6 years after that. So this is rather late in Madison's life when he writes this letter. But he's talking about the people and the relationship between constituents and government again in this letter to his friend Barry in 1822. And he makes the following statement: a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. If I can, I'm going to read that whole statement again, because I think it is so telling and so important. A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. There's so much in that quote that I've got to tell you that in the book that I'm writing, that quotation is the opening of the preface to the book. That quotation is the takeoff, is going to be the takeoff to the entire book. It is so rich in what it says. So in a sense, Madison has not lost his faith in the need for the people to be cognizant of what's happening and to be actively involved in the political process. It is absolutely vital, Madison says, that the people have information, that they have access to it, that they have the means of acquiring it. This gets into the whole issue of the Bill of Rights, freedom of the press, free speech, all the rest of it. I would suggest to you that the Bill of Rights, as implemented in 1791, is added to the Constitution once they are ratified in 1791. The Bill of Rights, more than anything else, speaks to the realities of the political process, the need for people to be tuned in and have access to information, government to be open, the press to be free, speech to be free, assembly to be free, and all the rest of it. The nature of the government that we have created absolutely requires a give and take back and forth between the people and government. Madison has not at all lost his commitment to that reality. And he said, if you have a government, a popular government, that where people cannot get information or cannot offer an opinion or speak their point of view, then your popular government, he says, becomes a farce or a tragedy, or maybe both. The title of the book we are writing is called Prologue to Tragedy. And it's taken directly from this quote. Madison says that knowledge will always govern ignorance. And if people mean to be their own governors, they must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. So, of course, the question raised there is two issues. What kind of knowledge gives that kind of power? What kind of power? We just discussed earlier today about the ratification of the Constitution and the transition of power from constituents to representative. So what power is Madison talking about? And what kind of knowledge is going to create that power? I personally struggle with this contradiction in the founders, in Madison specifically, but in the founders generally, because I think that there is an obvious contradiction here. The fact that the people are intelligent enough to hold their elected officials, keep their elected officials on the straight and narrow, and at the same time, the fact that the general population is not intelligent enough to know what's in its own best interest, I see as a contradiction. And I think that it's a contradiction in the founders as well. I think if you look at, if you're inclined, as sometimes I am, to look at the world from an either-or perspective, I don't think an either-or answer works here. And so I want to kind of suggest another thing. If I can take time with you, I'd like to go back into the 18th century a little bit and share a story. I always tell my students all the time, if history is anything, history is story. And the more students recognize the fact that history is story, the more it becomes narrative, the more it becomes a story that people can get into, the more appreciative students become of it, and the easier it is to understand. Because, I think that's very important. Let's go back a year before the Constitutional Convention. Let's go back to the period when the advocates for a change, the advocates for what becomes the Constitution of the United States, the Federalists, so to speak, during the 1780s, they aren't called Federalists yet. They're called Nationalists because they want a stronger national government and weaker, and consequently weaker state governments. The process which leads to the Constitution of the United States is a very, very interesting one. More important than that, it is a process that is laid out in every single American history textbook I've ever. It is told in a way which students usually fail to appreciate, and very honestly, which is, goes back to the grant that I wrote, the Teaching American History grant program that we had. It is a process that teachers of American history, for the most part, don't really understand. The nationalists are trying to strengthen the central government from the get-go. In fact, I mean, I didn't plan to mention this, but I think it seems to fit here very, very well. I don't know if any of you have ever wondered why it takes so long to end the American Revolution. If you think about it, the defeat of the British, at Yorktown, the defeat of Cornwallis at Yorktown, is in 1781. But the peace treaty ending the war with Great Britain is not until until the spring of 1783. So it takes 2 years from the time that the heat of the battle ends until the peace treaty is approved. And, of course, the story of America's diplomats, of Benjamin Franklin and John Adams in Europe and all the rest of it, is a story in itself. I won't go into that here. But the point is, one of the reasons why it takes so long between the end of the war for independence and the treaty which officially ends it is because many advocates of a strong central government in America realize that once the war ends, the possibility of strengthening the central government becomes much more difficult. And there are some leading proponents, nationalists, during this period, one of whom is Alexander Hamilton, very, very involved in the process of trying to strengthen the central government. And they realize that their best hope of strengthening the central government is to do it while the war is still underway. Once the war ends, then you're going to have to live with what you get, which becomes the Articles of Confederation. So there's a conscious effort to strengthen the central government from the very, very beginning, and Alexander Hamilton is critical to this. In fact, there is during the war, before the war ends, there is a prospective mutiny underway within the Continental Army at Newburgh, New York. And George Washington is able to get a handle on it and pull the plug on that. And there's no question that Hamilton himself is involved in that process. Basically, what happens is that since the Continental Congress does not have the power to tax, it doesn't have the power to pay the troops in the army. And there's a threat that the Continental Army is going to refuse to disband unless it's paid. And this prospective mutiny within the Continental Army is led by prominent people. It's called the Newburgh Conspiracy. And Alexander Hamilton is very, very much involved in that process. And the political reasons for that are, very honestly, that these nationalists like Hamilton know that once the war ends and once the peace treaty is signed, then it's going to be much more difficult to strengthen the central government. Well, as we know, the peace treaty is signed. And from that point on, the nationalists begin to adopt one strategy after another to try to find a way to strengthen the central government. They're trying to give the central government the power to tax. Because as the Articles of Confederation written, the central government does not have revenue. It does not have access to revenue. If this sounds familiar to you, given what's happening today, think of the battles that President Obama is having trying to get something through Congress, because Congress controls revenue. Congress controls taxation. And so basically, the idea is that the federal government during the Confederation has to get its resources from the states. The only revenue it has is from the states, because only the states have the power to tax. And so the nationalists believe that if they can find a way to get the federal government an independent stream of dollars, an independent source of revenue, then that will be the first step towards strengthening the central government. So they try to do it with an impost, which Congress defeats. They try to do it with a tax on imports, the idea being that a tariff would create the kind of revenue that Congress could begin to do business with, but it's unsuccessful. Finally, they decide that a major area of possibility that has possibilities is commerce. Because the way things are written, while the states control their own commerce within their own states, what do you do, for example, on the Potomac River, which runs right between Maryland and Virginia into Chesapeake Bay? Who controls the commerce? Who gets the revenue from commerce on the Potomac River, since it's not in one state or the other? Rather, it forms the border between the states. Nationalists begin to see that this has all sorts of possibilities in terms of getting states together and shifting the conversation from commerce to the power of the government, da-da-da-da-da, and ultimately to a revision of the Articles of Confederation. So in March of 1785, in what most of our textbooks include, they call it the Mount Vernon Conference. The states of Virginia and Maryland meet at Mount Vernon to talk about commerce and revenue on commerce from the Potomac River. Now, what, you know, I've kind of looked into this, and what happens is the governor of Maryland and the governor of Virginia are in contact, and they begin to decide, we really need to get together to talk about commerce. And when Washington hears this, and this is the way I explain it to students, I'm sure it's not this way, but I usually make the point, and I said, when Washington's idea was, why don't you all come to Mount Vernon? We'll have Martha will make cornbread and grits and beans and brown beans and cornbread and grits and all the rest of it, and we'll all sit down together and talk about commerce. So anyway, they meet at Mount Vernon. And what comes out of that is the idea that maybe, rather than just Virginia and Maryland meeting about commerce, why don't we invite other states to a conference on commerce? Why don't we use commerce, the inability of Congress to control interstate commerce, why don't we use that as a vehicle to get the states together and reopen discussions about the power of the central government vis-a-vis the Articles of Confederation? So what they decide to do in 1785 at the Mount Vernon Conference is to call a commercial conference together for the next April excuse me, the next fall, in September, in Annapolis, Maryland. And so a call is put out to all 13 states asking them to send representatives to a commercial conference, which is scheduled to meet in Annapolis, Maryland, in September, late September of 1786. And that is the famous Annapolis Convention. Well, most of the textbooks will tell us that the Annapolis Convention, now I'm in the text, I'm not in the history here, I'm talking about the way the textbooks present this to us and to our students. The next paragraph in the textbook deals with the Annapolis Convention, and it points out that it was a failure because only five states sent representatives. And the only saving grace of the Annapolis Convention is that Alexander Hamilton, a representative from the state of New York, is able to get the five states that are in attendance to agree to send out a call for yet another conference the next May in Philadelphia, and that becomes the Constitutional Convention. The difference is that whereas the Annapolis Convention was called to discuss commerce, the Philadelphia Convention is called to discuss revising the Articles of Confederation. In other words, they finally decided everybody knows what's going on anyway. We might as well put all of our cards on the table. The issue, why do we think that only five states showed up at Annapolis? And the answer is because everybody knew that this conference, while it was called to discuss commerce, really wasn't about commerce at all. It was about strengthening the powers of the central government, and that meant weakening the power of their own state governments, and the states didn't want any part of it. The most unbelievable, when I wrote my dissertation on this particular period in Maryland, my dissertation is on ratification of the Constitution in the state of Maryland. And one of the things that is astounding is that the state of Maryland refuses to attend the Annapolis Convention, even though it is meeting in the same building as the Maryland legislature in Annapolis. The Maryland legislature passes a resolution forbidding its members to participate in the conference that is underway elsewhere in this building. So Maryland is so conscious of the fact that there's a move afoot to reduce the power of the state government in the process of enhancing the power of the federal government that Maryland refuses to allow its own legislators to attend that conference. So, in a sense, the Annapolis Convention is a failure only in the sense that it only attracts five states. But it is a success in that it basically issues the call for what becomes the Constitutional Convention. And, of course, the textbooks point this out. Why would only five states go to Annapolis and yet 12 of 13 states show up at Philadelphia the next spring? And the answer is, no sooner had the Annapolis Convention adjourned than Shays' Rebellion broke out in western Massachusetts, and the nationalists jump all over that and basically use fear of rebellions breaking out throughout the 13 colonies as a stimulus to try to get people to come to Philadelphia, and it's successful. Because when the Philadelphia Convention meets, 12 of the 13 states are there. Rhode Island's not there, but all the other 12 are there. So that's really the story, and all of that is in our textbooks. But it's written in textbookese, if that makes any sense. It's written in a way where students are not really encouraged to get the flavor, to see the story side of what's happening here. And part of the reason, very honestly, is because a lot of our teachers really don't know that story either. With that introduction, I want to take a few moments to share with you one of the most unbelievable letters that I've found from this period. This is a letter written on the 10th of October, 1786, Now, this is after the Annapolis Convention only attracts five states. They adopt the resolution to call the convention, for the next May, and then it adjourns. And this letter is a report on the state of politics in America during this period. The author of the letter is Louis Guillaume Otto is the charge affairs of the French government in New York. This is the official representative, ambassador of France to the Confederation, Louis Otto. He writes home to Paris to his boss, who is the very famous Comte de Vergennes. Vergennes is French foreign minister under the king. So this is the official report of the French ambassador to the United States back to the French foreign minister. And in it, he is talking about the political situation within the American states. It is one of the most unbelievable letters I have ever read in this period. It's important to know that story about the Annapolis Convention and all of that, because that's the context within which this letter is written. If I can, let me share it with you and do the best I can. My Lord, the commissioners named by various states to propose a general plan of commerce and to give to Congress the powers necessary to execute it were meeting in Annapolis over the last month. But only five states being represented, they did not think they should broach the principal question, and they limited themselves to addressing to Congress and to the various legislators a report that characterizes the present spirit of this country's politics. Let me point out one thing. When Otto tells Vergennes that because there were only five states there, they didn't think it would be a good idea to approach the principal question. The principal question is revision of the Articles of Confederation. But since there were only five there, they couldn't do anything anyway, so they didn't mention it. Instead, they concentrate on writing an address to Congress and to the state legislatures, a formal report which is going to invite them all to send representatives to Philadelphia the next May. The next sentence speaks volumes. In translating this report, Otto says, I have taken care not only to put it into French, but to render it intelligible. They endeavored to give the original an obscurity that the people will see through with difficulty, but which the powerful and enlightened citizens would not fail to turn to account. What Otto is reporting back to France is that the report that comes out of the Annapolis Convention is written in such a way that the people can't understand what the real issues are, but the most powerful and enlightened citizens will understand perfectly what's going on. In a sense, official reports are being transmitted in America, knowing full well that the citizens of this country will never be able to understand the real issues in terms of what's going on. This, I believe, is absolutely incredible. Then Otto goes on and tells Vergennes what's happening in politics in America during this period. And he says, for a very long time, my lord, they have felt the necessity of giving the federal government more energy and vigor. But they have also felt that the excessive independence accorded to the citizens with regard to the states and to the states with regard to Congress is too dear to individuals for them to be divested of it without great precautions. In other words, the people know that they have so much power under the states and the Confederation that they're going to be very suspicious of any effort to change that. He goes on, the people are not unaware of the natural consequences of a greater power accorded to the government. Let me repeat that sentence. The people are not unaware that the natural consequences of a greater power accorded to the government will be a regular collecting of taxes, a strict administration of justice, extraordinary duties on imports, strict actions against debtors, and lastly, a marked preponderance of the rich men and the great proprietors. In other words, the people know very well that the result of a change in government to make it more effective and more efficient is going to mean regular collection of taxes. It's going to mean a government that can enforce the law. It's going to mean a government which can make people pay their debts. And it's going to mean a government in which the most prominent and virtuous citizens run things. They know that. It is, therefore, Otto says, in the interest of the people to preserve as much as possible the absolute liberty that was accorded them at a time when they knew no law than necessity, and when an English army laid, so to speak, the foundation of the political constitution. What Otto was saying is, they were able to get the Confederation passed because they had to fight a war against the mother country. And in the process, they created a government with power at the state level. Now that the people have that, they're not going to give it up. It is in these tempestuous times, Otto says, that it was necessary to agree that all power should emanate from the people, that everything be submitted to its supreme will, and that the magistrates be only its servants. That last sentence speaks volumes as well. It is in this situation, he says, that they began to tell people that all power in a republican government must come from the people, Declaration of Independence, consent of the governed, and that everything must be submitted to the people's supreme will, and that magistrates, elected representatives, are only the servants of the people. In other words, it's at this point that they began to realize the only way to get a change is to convince the people that republican government would never change and that the people would always be sovereign. So the process of selling the Constitution begins here, even before it's drafted. Then he goes on to tell us about the nature of the political society that exists in America. And Otto says to Virginia, although there were no patricians in America, there is a class of men known under the denomination of gentlemen, who by their wealth, by their talents, by their education, their families, or their positions they fill, aspire to a preeminence that the people refuse to accord them. And although several of these men have betrayed the interests of their class in order to acquire popularity, there reigns among them a liaison all the more intimate, since they fear almost all the efforts of the people to despoil them of their possessions, and since they are in addition creditors, and consequently interested in strengthening the government and attending to the execution of the laws. What he is pointing out to Virginie is that the prominent people who are creditors are in communication with each other. This is a class-based effort to change government in America. These people all have one thing in common. They're very fearful of the efforts of the people to despoil them of their possessions. They're afraid of the power of the people. And they also are in favor of strengthening government because they are creditors and they want their debts to be paid to them. These men ordinarily pay the highest taxes, while the small proprietors escape the vigilance of the collectors. Most of them are merchants. It is important to them to solidly establish the credit of the United States in Europe, by the exact payment of debts and to have Congress given sufficiently extensive power to make these people contribute thereto. So in a sense, what he's suggesting is the nature of the people who want to strengthen the central government is very clear. They are in communication with each other. They know what their interests are, and they know what they have to do to make the change. They have, whatever they do, they have to sell it in such a way that the people believe that they are in control of their magistrates, that the people are supreme, and that all power emanates only from the people. And that's where the whole process of these phrases like popular sovereignty and consent of the governed and all this stuff become political realities in a political process, which clearly Otto is telling his supervisor in France is underway. And then he goes on and he tells him a little bit, quite a bit further, and he uses the very word pretext. And I just want to read that sentence. He says, in proposing a new organization of the federal government, they would have caused all minds to rebel. There's no way they could be open and say what it is that they are about. Ruinous circumstances for the commerce of America have happily chanced to furnish the reformers a pretext to introduce innovation. In other words, because of the situation that currently exists, they can basically create a sense of urgency among the people. And he tells them how that's going to happen. They represented to the people that the name American had become a disgrace among all the nations of Europe. In other words, they're telling people that European governments are making fun of us. That the flag of the United States is everywhere exposed to insults and vexations. That the farmer, no longer being able to freely export his products, would soon be reduced to the last misery. That it was time to employ reprisals and to prove to foreign nations that the United States would not suffer this violation of the freedom of commerce with impunity, but that vigorous measures could only be taken by unanimous consent of the 13 states, and that Congress, not having the necessary powers, it was essential to form a General Assembly charged to present it with a plan that it should adopt. The people, generally discontented with the difficulties of commerce and little suspecting the secret motives of their antagonists, embraced this measure with ardor, named commissioners who were supposed to meet at Annapolis the commencement of September. In other words, what he's saying is the reason the people sent representatives to the Annapolis Convention in the first place is because they were convinced that America was being laughed at overseas, that America was not getting any respect, that our commerce was being shut off, that our farmers were suffering, and that we needed to make some substantial changes, not only in commerce, but in the nature of government itself. It was when that case is made that people in five states sent delegates to Annapolis. But again, only five states did that. The Patrick Henrys and the Richard Henry Lees and the Samuel Chases in Maryland, for example, and the Charles Carroll of Carrolltons in Maryland, and the other anti-federalist leaders throughout become anti-federalists once the Constitution becomes the issue, they basically are aware. Patrick Henry says in Virginia, I smell a rat. And he makes the case in the Virginia legislature that Virginia shouldn't go near this thing. That he said, I smell a rat, and I don't want to go. But, of course, he loses because Madison is behind it. So that really is one of the most unbelievable letters. I'd like to focus on it as we go forward. But we've actually gone a little bit past the top of the hour. Let's pause and take a 4 or 5 minute break. This is the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. I am Bill O'Brien, and after 4 or 5 minute break, we'll be right back. This is Bill O'Brien back with you for our second hour, a little bit less than that actually now, for our virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. And I understand we have a caller.
We do indeed, Dr. Bill. Betsy is with us.
Betsy, it is wonderful to hear from you.
Hey, Dr. Bill, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So I have a teacher in Texas, and I sent you a couple of emails, but one of the things that I'm finding is that we are experiencing a time when we are, there is so much emphasis on other things that social studies, whether it's geography or history or government, all of it is put on such a back burner that in my school it is relegated to 20 minutes a day, and no one in administration will tell me which 20 minutes I'm supposed to use.
Well, it really doesn't matter to them.
No, there is no 20 minutes.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Right.
You know, I work a grant. I have a grant with teachers, and they tell me pretty much the same thing, that they're told that they're to teach reading and they're to teach math and they're to teach science and not to do these things at all. The other option
I'm allowed to put social studies at individual learning centers, but not in anything that uses my time.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Fifth grade is not a time for learning social studies by independent study.
No. And you know, my teachers have said that, teachers I work with have said that they try to combine reading with social studies by having them read historical texts, especially primary sources, which they've been using more and more since we've been working on this grant. But
That only works with certain items at certain times, and you have to have the materials. So the readers that we use had a whole lot of, three or four different stories and historical fiction and actual history about the American Revolution.
Uh-huh.
But then when we were supposed to go into the Constitution from there in our social studies curriculum, the book instead went to fiction for six chapters. And then it came back to history in the 1840s with Wexford expansion. If you weren't using a history book for the 6 weeks in between, the kids have absolutely no idea what Wexford expansion is or what's going on, and we have no time to build context for what they're reading, meaning that they're just reading adventure stories that take place in a period of history that they've never heard of, in places that they've never heard of.
You know, it's very interesting because I'm thinking back to what I've read and heard Senator Byrd from West Virginia speak about when he started this grant program at all, and he told horror stories like this. And his argument is that history, American history, has been pushed on the back burner, to the point that our people don't know anything, therefore they don't appreciate anything, therefore they can't function intelligently in this political process. And the result is, I think, is that the political process is making decisions, bad decisions, very honestly.
Absolutely, I agree completely. And the other thing I'm seeing, my son went through, he's in college now, and he went through school in gifted and talented programs, honors programs, and at the same time that he was doing that, I was actually observing social studies teachers at a different high school in the same district. The two high mm-hmm. schools were maybe 6 miles apart and completely different demographics.
Yeah.
My son was getting reasonably high quality, reasonably in-depth world history, U.S. history, world geography, pretty good stuff. He was getting mm-hmm. Pretty good. And the things that were being done there were night and day different from the history and government classes across town which were not honors and not GT.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know who Cassie is from the Horn?
I've heard Bob mention her before, yes.
So she's she grew up in the Horn. She's in college as well. And she lived, when she was in high school, she lived right near me.
Uh-huh.
And when I heard her talk about some of her social studies teachers and the things that she was doing and learning, and she had a debate-based class where they learned history as, you know, partly with direct instruction, but largely by having the kinds of debates and discussions that you advocate in your program.
Uh-huh.
And this was at the same time. My son was in eighth grade. And I guess, my son was in sixth grade. She was in eighth grade when I was looking at the social studies materials for the high school or looking, well, I was adapting them to a certain population. And I went and visited with Cassie's teacher because I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I was seeing the results. And so I went and I said, can I observe and can I meet with you? And she graciously allowed me to do both. And I sat down with her and I said, I absolutely love what you're doing. How do we make it happen, and how did you get it through the district? And she said, most principals won't allow it, and it won't work with your population. It only works with GT students who are strong readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had that in the back of my mind, and then to hear you talk 2 days ago about how you are working with teachers who are using, and that you're finding that what you're using builds the literacy.
Yes.
So that they can do more of it in the future. That's something that I, as a teacher, want to know more about. It's something that I've always, you know, I certainly believe, I'd love to see studies. I would love to, because I'm working at a school right now where they don't want kids reading anything that's not at their DRA level, which is a reading test that involves oral reading and pronunciation and writing, and actually doesn't test reading, to my understanding of what reading really is.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not allowed to make decisions about what kids read that are not guided by that data point.
Oh, well, we've got a new set of core standards here in the state of West Virginia that just became operative this past September, only in the social studies. They're not going to become operative in science and math until the fall of next fall, 2013. But 2013-2014 academic year standards now come under language and literature, rhetoric. So in a sense, the whole social studies curriculum has been put under languages and literature, which means that whatever you do has to be in the context of teaching reading and critical reading and writing and all of those. But on the other hand, that's better than what we were getting before. Because most of the standards that our teachers are dealing with now are asking them, I mean, the objectives that they have are things like understand and rank the importance of and evaluate of and come up with alternatives to, and these kinds of things that most of our teachers have had no experience at all in their preparation for teaching, let alone getting students to do those things. And so my sense is that, and that's what we've been talking about with our teachers, if we can focus as much as possible on primary sources and have them do that and research them and basically fashion it as language instruction, as language arts.
Right.
But
I
in reality,
what you're doing is brilliant, actually.
Well, I don't know if it's brilliant or not, because very honestly, I think Bob can probably tell you more specifics than this, but, and I'll be very honest, we have lost an awful lot of archers. And not all because of the methodology. I mean, like any situation, our teachers have, some of them come across very personal situations, you know, illness and job loss and various other things. But, the fact of the matter is, we're asking an awful lot of our teachers. And one of the things that we've tried to do, what I've tried to do, is tell them, caution them over and over again. It's not a question of following your marching orders or doing this. We don't want you to get into that kind of a bind. What we want to try to figure out a way to do is take what we're doing and make it work within the context that they're insisting that you follow. And so far, I think we've been able to do it, but we're doing it with a lot fewer teachers than I wish we had. And in fact, Betsy, part of the reason that I want to do this program is because I'm hoping that by doing these kinds of things, we can reach more people and get more people to try different things. Because we've got to do something. We're condemning our youngsters to a level of dependency and career disappointment that is just unfair. So I don't know what else to say, but do you go in every morning with a smile on your face?
I try to. I mean, the current school that I'm at makes it very difficult. I mean, I find it very difficult to do that. Well, when I'm with my students and I'm teaching, I'm fine. I'm better than fine. I'm on fire, and the kids are learning, and there's amazing things happening. Bob was actually a guest speaker in my classroom via Skype last week. There are amazing things happening in my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But the most amazing things are the things that happen when the door is closed.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
And so I'm looking for other employment. I don't know that I could do this in public school anymore. I certainly don't think I can do it at this. Well, I know I can't do it at this school.
You know, Betsy, I believe.
And I'm looking at all kinds of things because this is just not working for me.
I know. I understand. One of the things that, and I may be the most incredibly naive optimist in the world, but one of the things that I am coming to realize is that an awful lot of the people who can really make a difference, the people who have some say in these kinds of rules and regulations that we operate under, don't know a lot of this stuff. Yeah. I mean, I really think that, you know, I mean, this stuff about, I mean, one of the areas where I plan to go in the next, you know, not only today, but next week as well, is into the whole issue of education, because I see this sense that when you said that this teacher friend of yours told you that miraculous things, very exciting things are happening in her class, but they can't work with your students, that they can only work with a certain caliber of students. That is an assumption that I think we've got to challenge.
I agree.
And I guess the only way to challenge it, is to give the vast majority of students an opportunity to prove that they're wrong. And, you know, that's my feeling, because I find in teaching college classes, for example, I find that students I interact with become very angry when they confront these things, when they hear these quotes by people that they've always been taught, you know, by the Jeffersons and the Benjamin Rushes and people. And basically what they're saying is, you can't handle anything but this level. The real good stuff we're saving for the people who have much more intelligence and capability than you have. This makes people very, very angry.
It should. I'm glad it makes them angry.
Well, that's what I'm hoping.
That's better than looking at it and saying, yeah, they're right. I could never understand that.
Exactly. I see a little bit
of that for my students. I see that often, yeah. When they see a book that looks too hard.
You see surrender.
Yes.
I was just going to tell you a story. One of the teachers that we have, she's become one of our best. But the first grant that we had, it was in 2003. She was in the first group of teachers that we got. And I was basically laying out on the first day what it was, the kinds of things we were going to do. And she made the comment and said, my students can't do that. They, most of them can't even read. I mean, I remember her saying that. And I said, and her name was Mary. And I said, Mary, my God, you're their teacher. If you believe that, what chance do they have?
Yeah.
Their parents might believe that. But as a teacher of these children, you can't afford, you can't afford to believe that. My God, how are you going to go to work every day if you believe that? If you believe you're dealing with kids who can only do a certain amount, who can't do the stuff that's really important, then you're condemning them to failure before they even have a chance to know that there's anything going on. You know, and I don't know. I know what you're saying. I find that college students get mad. The issue is whether in fact they take the next step from getting mad and say, I'm going to prove something different and not go the route that you suggest, which is kind of throw up their hands and say, the heck with it. I'll just find a way to make it through and pretend that I'm interested and get out of here. And, you know, I mean, I've talked to students who really believe that until they graduate from high school. Now I'm dealing with students who believe it in college. They don't believe that their life really begins until after they get out of college. That's when I go to work, and that's when the real world begins. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, we can't let you continue to believe that. If you don't believe that this stuff matters, what we've done is we've dumbed down the education process to the point that even the students recognize that it's a game.
Bill, you have no idea how much the education process has been dubbed down. There's no literature. There's no literature in my school. There is absolutely nothing that wasn't written either by a textbook company or adapted and dubbed down, or a lot of our reading program, which includes a lot of the historical fiction and a lot of the history that I use, is stuff from a website on the internet that we are supposed to print and staple together.
Mm-hmm.
There is, forget primary sources. There are no sources.
There are no sources.
Everything is, it's baby food.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just everything is, you know, run through the blender, and then we like baby food.
Yeah. Oh my heavens. Well, I know. I mean, I can tell
the apple. It's the applesauce, and we spoon feed it.
Yeah. And it's all information driven. It's all right answers. It's all standardized tests.
No, information would be fine. My kids beg for information. It's skills driven.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. And, you know, I've had students say, you know, I'll have a book or I'll, you know, invite them to read something and I'll say, I think you'll enjoy this. And they'll look at the back and go, well, this is a 3.8 and I only read a 3.2. And I'll just look right at them and go, if you're interested in it, you'll make it work. Read with a friend, read with me, read it twice, read with a dictionary. If you're interested in it, make it work. And I get in trouble for that. But I would much rather spark their interest and have them learn how to teach themselves from books than to have them always look at the back of the book to see what reading level it is and whether or not some test has told them they can handle it. I would rather, are you there? Bill, are you there?
Stand by, Betsy. I'm going to reconnect to Dr. Bill.
Okay.
And I bet that's Dr. Bill now.
Leave we're back, Bob.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know where we got lost, though.
I don't know whether you we got disconnected. It could be on my end, but anyway, I was responding to your issue of skills because what I find in talking to teachers is that kids don't read literature anymore. Rather, their goal is to basically become familiar with the plot, know who the heroines are, the villains, and so
describe,
because that's what they
setting,
understand.
They have to describe the setting. They have to describe the problem.
Yeah, yeah. But they don't read the book,
actually,
so therefore,
to understand it and to appreciate it. That's
And appreciate that they are encountering examples of what people go in learning how to live life. They don't have time to read that stuff. So all they do is they go to the last chapter to find out who the villain was or who the hero was or whatever, and that's all they're expected to know. So all the content, all the literature itself, which is character development and the moral choices and ethical choices that people have to make in life, it's all lost. It all falls through the cracks and they never experience it. So therefore, when they get out into the real world, they've had absolutely no exposure to any of this stuff. I have literature teachers tell me that all the time.
Yeah.
And I
have colleagues who don't read and they teach elementary school.
Oh,
I don't understand that at all. I do not understand.
We have Bob will be very familiar with this, but we have an organization of school systems here that we're working with in our grant. And one of the director of professional development for this organization sat in my office and told me that one of the reasons we were losing teachers in our grant program is because we were asking them to read too much, and this is a quote, our teachers are so busy that they don't have time to read. And so
I'm so busy, I don't have time to use the restroom.
My
entire first semester, I did not read. My bedtime reading every night first semester was a curriculum guide.
Oh, that's
there are many reasons why I'm leaving this school.
I guess our education system has a long way to go, doesn't it?
It really does.
Does. Well, as I told you when you sent me an email, please hang and teach. Please teach, because we need people that can see through this. I know I'm naive. I know I'm an idealist. But I have to believe that many of the people who are responsible for some of this don't really understand what it is I have teachers tell me that administrators at the system level or at the state level or whatever really think that when they have meetings with other people at their level, that they are discussing the problems of the classroom. And as he said, one of my teachers said, they have no more idea of what's happening in the classrooms of West Virginia than the man in the moon.
So we actually have visitors to our classrooms all the time. The district people come to the classroom, but they are looking for uniformity. They are looking for systems that are in place. They are looking for they're looking for small group learning, because mm-hmm. that's apparently the only way kids learn these days is if they're in small groups.
Mm-hmm.
They're not looking for thinking.
No. And they're looking for order. It's unbelievable.
Right.
I can remember
and
my own
bulletin boards and professional dress.
Yeah. And many of our kids, teachers will tell me, many of our kids, it's a victory for them to even get to school because of the situations that they come from, many of them.
Yes.
And to expect them to learn is asking an awful lot. they're basically
the
just getting
now,
there for them.
My students love to learn. They want to learn. And I do history as story. That's the way I've always done history.
Yeah.
When I was teaching them the history of the colonists, and I was teaching whatever it was that I was teaching at the beginning of the year before I was told to do guided reading lessons instead, when I was doing that, the kids hung on every word. They loved it.
Yeah.
They absolutely loved it. And I was teaching literacy through it. I was doing all of the kinds of things that you talk about.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the way you were talking about it, and I was not using any primary sources, partly because we have a bilingual framework, and my bilingual framework would not allow me to use primary sources that are in English. I would have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I've never been in that situation.
I would have to do it during language arts.
Yeah.
And I had so many things that were brand new this year that I put it on the back burner. But I talked to them about primary sources a lot. And I talked to them about, you know, where do we get our history from? Because that was one of their questions. But how do we know this? I said, because people wrote things down. We could read their letters to each other. We could read the Declaration of Independence. And we actually, you know, found a very large, very high resolution image of the Declaration and put it up on the screen in the front of the classroom and tried to find things in it. And we did that one day just to sort of, you know, yes, we really can learn these things and historians can, you know, historians could learn from this and we could learn from this. Which nobody had ever told them before. They thought that it only came from books. And I'm like,
kids can learn. And this idea that only certain kids can learn and the vast majority cannot is killing us. It's killed us before and it's continuing to kill us. We in our I'm pontificating here a little bit, but I believe that our whole system is focused around finding the 10 to 12%. Who have learned how to play this game well, and we're just trying to keep the rest of them busy. And we're trying to compete in the world with an education system that is not focused on teaching all of its people, but on eliminating the people that we have defined as non-learners or incapable learners or insufficient learners, whatever you want to call them. Challenge students. Yeah, challenge you to come up with all these acronyms for them. Disturbed and attention deficit disorders and all of these other things. And the fact of the matter is we are not giving kids the opportunity.
We'll be right back.
You know, learning is a very, very exciting thing. And when people are learning, they remain on task. When you lose them is when there's no learning happening anymore.
I agree completely.
You know, so I know where you're coming from, but I don't know what I wish I did know the answer.
For me, the answer is probably to go back to private school or to go back to teaching adults or to go back to working with curriculum and not be in the classroom.
Yeah, because I understand what you're saying.
I don't think that I could make it in a public school classroom, in a regular public school classroom in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not right now.
Well, there are an awful lot of private school initiatives and experimental schools and various other things because it appears that people are trying to find answers, but I don't think they're, you know, I don't think they're looking. I don't think we've ever, as a society, confronted the fact that you know, encouraging all of our trying to teach all of our children to learn to reach their own abilities, and knowing that everyone has talent, it's just a question of finding what it is and then cultivating it. I don't think we play lip service to it, but I don't think we really believe it. I think we're afraid of it. I know the founder. I mean, in the 18th century, they were desperately afraid of it. They talked about what would happen if during the Revolution when people, because of the Declaration, and people actually began to believe that when this war was over, when we won our independence, we were going to have a society in which everybody was really going to be equal, and there was not going to be any artificial deference, and everybody was going to have a real opportunity to be successful, and all the things that the Declaration talks about. And some of the more prominent people in several of the colonies and states were basically writing to each other back and forth and saying, "My God, this is frightening." These, you know, there's a quotation from Boston about a doctor who makes this comment and said, "There are people riding around the streets of Boston in carriages with lace cuffs, you know, with lace on their cuffs, who 10 years ago were not worthy to shine my shoes. Who the hell do they think they are?" And these people believed the world was coming to an end because people really believed that in this society, people ought to really have a chance to be equal and to reach their potential. I believe that's what makes us an exceptional nation, is that on paper, we're still committed to that. We just got to do it. We have to have faith in it.
But I also think that we're working very hard at recreating separate but equal. Separate but unequal.
I think you're right. I think we are. My support for Bob and for the horn, and you know, I mean, I think we've just gotta keep this stuff out there. We've just gotta keep pushing it, because and again, I think a lot of times people don't really understand what it is that they're keeping from happening, that they're preventing from happening. I mean, I don't think people really know. I mean, I can remember that in the, you know, in one of the sources I gave this as a final exam question. But in God, it was only right after 1816, right after the War of 1812. The Senate of the United States is debating a bill to tax books from foreign countries in order to keep them out of here. And the chairman of the Senate committee that wrote the bill defends it by saying, as representatives of our people, we have a unique government. Our students are very special. We can't allow them to be exposed to all these strange foreign ideas. What we have to do as government is to protect them.
This still exists today. I work in bilingual classrooms, but every single one of the materials that's written in Spanish is from the United States, or is in translation. There is absolutely nothing authentic from a Latin American or Spanish country, because we don't want our kids to have that.
Yeah.
We're scared of that.
Yeah, we're scared of it. And you're
we're
right.
Scared
I think,
of that.
And I think it's fair. I don't think it's necessarily it translates into hostility and meanness, but I really think it's based on fear. And of course, a lot of violence is based on fear. I don't know. And that's interesting that materials given to Spanish children would be written here. So in other words, it's all censored.
Everything. And not just the majority, everything. Every Spanish book in the library is produced in the United States.
Yeah.
They don't see British English. They don't see anything that is not, like I said, everything is packaged and broken down into baby food for them, including the Spanish.
Yeah.
And this was not always the case. I've been teaching for 25 years. This was not always the case.
No.
My first classroom, I would say about a quarter of my materials came from other countries.
And
it was perfectly acceptable to buy them.
Well, people used to read Dickens. They don't even read him anymore, you know, in literature class.
12th grade. So in the schools here, and this is one of my other pet peeves, government and economics classes here are taught in grade 12, which means that for kids who are dropping out,
they don't get
government.
They never get it, no.
And we have a 20 to 30% dropout rate.
Yeah, we do too. We do too.
And so we just write those kids off. The same thing is true. British literature is 12th grade.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
or world literature.
So you think that your best avenue for you, Betsy, would be to get into an area of education where you design curriculum?
I did that for several years.
Uh huh.
I did curriculum for bilingual classrooms and English as a second language.
Yeah. That's a tremendous need and There's power in that, Betsy.
The problem is I was grant funded. So basically I had 10 years of being grant funded and my job description changed slightly or completely every 3 years. But then we had budget cuts. For that, the grant ran out. The school adopted me, and 2 years later, we had budget cuts.
Yeah. Yeah, and because we're all facing those now. Well, I'm in search of funding for the center, for this idea of the center, but it's not the time to be out there looking for funding, I'll tell you.
No.
And so it's extremely difficult. But I guess the mere fact that you're tuned into this network indicates that you're a fighter, and I really appreciate that very much. I really do. But
and I appreciate what you're doing, and I will leave you to do it for a
Betsy,
few more minutes.
Betsy, thank you. Thank you so much.
Well,
I appreciate hearing from you. I've heard so much about you, and I've read your emails, and it's just an honor to talk to you.
It's wonderful to talk to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wow, I'm speechless. I should tell my wife. My wife is elsewhere, and when did I tell her that I was speechless? Because she's convinced that I've never experienced that. Wow. I think I just talked to one of our best teachers, folks. I think I really did. I hope all those tuned in appreciate that as well. But again, our teachers are wonder. When you realize how hard they work, and it's just, you know, my what keeps me going is the idea that if we can just begin to let them see what the hard work that they do might cause to happen, then unbelievable things can happen. I don't know where this is going to go, but I met yesterday morning here in southern West Virginia with a local school official in our county schools, and he's going to support with me for this fall. What I'm intending to do is kind of put together a course in this founding material, in the founding of the American Republic, a course primarily based on primary source materials and creative writing and student research that's going to be a problem-based course that will be offered technologically. It'll be an online class and will be made available to the four high schools in our county. I'm hoping that our local Rotary Club here will help bear the expenses for this experiment. And that's the way I've painted it. I'm going to be president of our local Rotary Club here, and that's one of the things that our people have been desperate to find a project, our Rotary people. We have a really good club, and they really want a project that they can all get behind and embrace. And I'm hoping that this might be it, but I don't become president until July, so we'll see what happens. But I'm trying to lay the groundwork for this effort. And then if I can get all the pieces in place, then I'm going to basically present it to the Rotary and basically say, I think I may have the project. And what we can do is we can conduct an educational experiment here, which will measure and monitor to the point that when it's over, we'll be able to demonstrate to the world that we have made something happen that might not have been able to happen without the Rotary Club and without the support of the Rotary, et cetera. So I'm hoping, you know, and as I told my wife, I just want so much to contribute to making a difference. I know that I've talked to Bob Kincaid over the years, and he feels the same way. And that's really one of the reasons that the horn is on the air. And I feel like it's a tremendous asset. What an important thing. So anyway, we've got about 10 minutes left in our time together today, and we won't be back together again until Monday. Going to try to do make one slight change for Monday. I want to alert our listeners to this. I'm going to try to do it from 3 to 5 on Monday. I chair a board here at a local hospital, which meets one Monday a month, the third Monday of every month, and it meets at 5:30. And so what we're going to try to do, and I've spoken to Bob about this, is instead of being on our regular 4 to 6 Eastern time on Monday, we'll do 3 to 5. And then Tuesday we'll go back to 4 to 6. Wednesday we'll go back to 4 to 6. And hopefully by the time we get to next week, we'll have cleaned out our glitches and our disconnects and our problems with signal and all of those things. Bob and I are both working on that. So I think by the time we get into next week and start to roll, we'll be really good. But on Monday, we'll be doing our program from 3 to 5 rather than 4 to 6. And then on Tuesday, we'll go back to the same thing. This gives me an opportunity. I didn't want to give up the chairman chair. I chair this hospital board for years and years, and it's one of the, you know, I have a very, very warm feeling for this hospital. It's kind of, if you know what I mean, it's kind of like the People's Hospital here in Southern West Virginia, if you know what I mean. It was Eleanor Roosevelt was here during the dedication, and John L. Lewis made appearances here. And I mean, it was originally called the Miners Hospital, West Virginia Miners Hospital, and it was created primarily to focus on black lung and on the illnesses of coal miners. And it's kind of the People's Hospital, and I love it. And I'm so fortunate for the last to sit on the board of this hospital for the last several years, and for the last 5 years I've been chairing it, and I want to kind of maintain the connection with the hospital, and therefore I've asked Bob for the opportunity to adjust the beginning time for our program on Monday, and he's agreed. So we'll do Monday from 3 to 5, and then on Tuesday we'll return to our 4 to 6 format. One of the things, and you know, kind of as a wind-up to today, but I don't know how, I'm going to wind up with something that I said, because I really don't feel like I can add anything to what Betsy said. I want people to leave today with the things that Betsy said kind of perking in their minds, because I don't think there's anything that I can say to make those any more powerful than they were. One of the most exciting things that has occurred, that has happened to me over the last couple of years, is this auto letter.
We will join Dr. Bill momentarily. Dr. Bill.
And not only is it one guy, but he's a foreigner. He's an ambassador from another country. And he's writing back to his people at home in France. So how do we know that what this guy says is real? In other words, why should we give too much credibility to this one letter? There aren't a whole bunch of letters that reinforce it, that say the same things. And my response to that is, think of the way we celebrate de Tocqueville's democracy in America. I mean, here's a visitor who came to the United States in the early 19th century, early 1800s. And, I mean, he was a visitor. He's not an ambassador. He's not a person whose job is to be able to know what's happening and be able to report it back to his employers. This guy is a visitor. And he goes around and he sees this and he sees that, and he writes his, you know, very, very positive responses to what we call democracy in America. And he's read everywhere, and everybody loves him because everything he said was positive. But on the other hand, his auto, who's saying things that many people who, once you read it, are not that comfortable with, and the first thing we try to do is find reasons why we can't believe this guy, or we can't take this guy seriously. I think we should take him very seriously, because everything that I've done in researching this period suggests that he's onto something. It's an unbelievably powerful letter, it seems to me. And not only is it powerful for the history that it reveals about the Annapolis Convention and about ways that the so-called gentlemen, what he talks about, the people throughout the states, who are in contact with each other and are very aware of what's happening and how volatile the political situation is in America and how much need there is for making the kind of change that the Constitution of the United States is going to implement, is going to bring about. Not only do we see that in this letter, But we also see something else, and this ties in a little bit with some of the things that Betsy was saying. We also see a realization that political reality is happening in this country, and it's happening without the general population really knowing what's going on. The general impression is, and I don't know how else to say this, but the way he refers to the report that comes out of the Annapolis Convention, it is written in a way that the people will have trouble understanding, but that the people who need to know what's going on will understand perfectly. Just think about that for a second. It's almost like official reporting and political reports are being in code. It's not an accident, for example, that these contracts that we're made to sign when we sign up for a credit card, for a MasterCard or a Visa card or a Discover card or anything else, or we get a credit card in one of the large department stores or something. It's not an accident that these codes are written, the little print on the back is written so small and written in a language that is legal language. That's what being an attorney is about, that you can't understand. In other words, what we're talking about here is we're putting our names to paper on documents that we can't understand and we don't read. If you've ever bought a house, you know what I'm talking about. If you've ever had to sign all of these papers where there's an attorney telling you, and you have to believe, you have to trust them, you'd never buy a house. You know, this paper says this and this paper says that, because you, if you ever took time to read all these documents, it would take 2 days to close a sale. So it's done on faith. And basically what I'm saying is it's not unheard of. It's not something out of the realm of possibility or reason that political leaders would know that there are certain things that they don't want the general population to understand. So they put it in a language, they write it in a way that they can't understand or that makes no sense to them. Betsy and I just had a conversation about the fact that that's the way textbooks are written. In the chapter on the Articles of Confederation in every American history textbook, the Mount Vernon Conference of March 1785, the Annapolis Conference of September 1786, those are in there. And the textbook tells us what happened there, but it tells us in a way that students really never become privy to what the story is, to the context and what's happening. These become isolated pieces of information that remain unconnected to anything else. And that's really, it seems to me, what the real issue is about that we're dealing with. My watch tells me that we're about 3 minutes before the top of the hour, and I know that Bob Kincaid is getting ready to fire up for his program at 6. So with that, I'm going to basically sign off for the day. First of all, by thanking you for listening, and mostly for thanking Betsy for calling. I encourage you to call, all of you, and share ideas and opinions and points of view, because that's really what this is about. This cannot remain a monologue, because I can't keep doing it. There's not that much. I don't know that much. There's not that much information to remain a monologue. We've got to make this a dialogue. I want to thank Betsy so much for calling. I hope all of you have a wonderful evening and a wonderful weekend, and Lord willing, we'll get back together again on Monday. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you for listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution.